having penetrated to within 10 yards of the embankment, the graybacks beat them back with rocks. All along the 2-mile front, the situation was desperate. No sooner was the pressure relieved in one spot than it increased again in another. Broken, then restored, Hill's line wavered like a shaken rope. He was down to his last ounce of strength, he reported, and still the bluecoats came against him, too thick and fast for killing to do more than slow them down. Whereupon Jackson, who had no reserves to send in response to Hill's plea for reinforcements, did something he had never done before. Outnumbered 3-1 by the attackers, whose bullets he was opposing with flung stones, he appealed to Lee to send him help from Longstreet. In the Federal ranks there was also a measure of consternation, especially at the brevity of what they had been assured was a pursuit. Recovering from the shock of this discovery, however, the men fought with redoubled fury, as if glad of a chance to take their resentment of Pope out on the rebels. As usual, McDowell came in for his share of their bitterness, as witness the following exchange between a gray-haired officer and a wounded non-com limping rearward out of the fight. "Sergeant, how does the battle go?" "We're holding our own, but McDowell has charge of the left." "Then God save the left." For the better part of an hour they came on, running hunched as if into a high wind, charging shoulder to shoulder across fields where long tendrils and sheets of gun smoke writhed and billowed, sulphurous and tinged with a hot coppery hue by the rays of the declining sun. One among them was to remember it so, along with the accompanying distraction of rebel shells, continually screeching over our heads or plowing the gravelly surface with an ugly rasping whir that makes one's flesh creep. Still they came on. Time after time they faltered within reach of the flame-stitched crest of the embankment, then time after time came on again, stumbling over the huddled blue forms that marked the limits of their previous advances. They battered thus at Jackson's line as if at a locked gate, beyond which they could see the cool green fields of peace. Determined to swing it ajar or knock it flat, they struck it again and again, flesh against metal, and feeling it tremble and crack at the hinges and hasp, they battered harder. Longstreet stood on the ridge where his and Jackson's lines were hinged. This not only gave him a panoramic view of the action, it also afforded an excellent position for massing the 18 guns of a reserve artillery battalion which had arrived at dawn. The batteries were sited so that they commanded, up to a distance of about 2,000 yards to the east and northeast, the open ground across which the Federals were advancing. For the better part of an hour, the cannoneers had watched hungrily while the blue waves were breaking against Stonewall's right and center, perpendicular to and well within range of their guns. This was the answer to an artillerist's prayer, but old Pete was in no hurry. He was saving this for a Sunday punch, to be delivered when the time was right and the final Union reserves had been committed. Then it came. Jackson's appeal for assistance, forwarded by Lee with the recommendation that a division of troops be sent. "Certainly," Longstreet said. He spoke calmly, suppressing the excitement he and all around him felt as they gazed along the troughs and crests of the blue waves rolling northward under the muzzles of his guns. "But before the division can reach him, the attack will be broken by artillery." So it was. When Longstreet turned at last and gave the signal that unleashed them, the gunners leaped to their pieces and let fly, bowling their shots along the serried rows of Federals who up to now had been unaware of the danger to their flank. The effect was instantaneous. Torn and blasted by this fire, the second and third lines milled aimlessly, bewildered, then retreated in disorder, whereupon the first line soldiers, looking back over their shoulders to find their supports in flight, also began to waver and give ground. This was that trembling instant when the battle scales of fortune signal change, one balance pan beginning to rise as the other sinks. Down on the flat, just after remarking calmly to one of his staff as he watched a line of wagons pass to the front, "I observe that some of those mules are without shoes. I wish you would see to it that all of the animals are shod at once." Lee heard the uproar and divined its meaning. Without a change of expression, he sent word to Longstreet that if he saw any better way to relieve the pressure on Jackson than by sending troops, he should adopt it. Headquarters wigwagged a signal station on the left. "Do you still want reinforcements?" When the answer came back, "No, the enemy are giving way," Lee knew the time had come to accomplish Pope's suppression by launching an all-out counterstroke to compound the blue confusion. An order went at once to Longstreet, directing him to go forward with every man in his command. It was not needed. Old Pete was already in motion, bearing down on the moil of Federals out on the plain. A similar order went to Jackson, together with a warning. "General Longstreet is advancing. Look out for and protect his left flank." But this also was unnecessary. When Stonewall's men saw the bluecoats waver on their front, they too started forward. Right and left, as the widespread jaws began to close, the weird halloo of the rebel yell rang out. Porter's corps was on the exposed flank, under the general direction of McDowell, and Porter, who had been expressing dark forebodings all along, "I hope Mac is at work and we will soon get ordered out of this," he had written Burnside the night before, had taken the precaution of stationing two New York regiments, the only volunteer outfits in Sykes's division of regulars, on his left as a shield against disaster. Facing west along the base of a little knoll on which a six-gun battery was posted, these New Yorkers caught the brunt of Longstreet's assault, led by Hood. One regiment, thrown forward as a skirmish line, was quickly overrun. The other, Zouaves, nattily dressed in white spats, tasseled fezes, short blue jackets, and baggy scarlet trousers, stood on the slope itself, holding firm while the battery flailed the attackers, then finally limbered and got away, permitting the New Yorkers to retire. They did this at a terrible cost, however. Out of 490 present when the assault began, 124 were dead and 223 had been wounded by the time it was over, which amounted to the largest percentage of men killed in any federal regiment in any single battle of the war. Next morning, one of Hood's men became strangely homesick at the sight of the dead Zouaves strewn about in their gaudy clothes. According to him, they gave the western slope of the little knoll the appearance of a Texas hillside when carpeted in the spring by wildflowers of many hues and tints. The respite bought with their blood, however brief, had given Pope time to bring up reinforcements from the right, and they too offered what resistance they could to the long gray line surging eastward along both sides of the pike. This was undulating country, with easy ridges at right angles to the advance, so that to one defender it seemed that the Confederates, silhouetted against the great red ball of the setting sun, came on like demons emerging from the earth. There was delay as Longstreet's left became exposed to enfilading fire from some batteries on Jackson's right, but when these were silenced, the advance swept on, tilted battle flags gleaming in the sunset. On Henry Hill, where Stonewall had won his nickname 13 months ago, Sykes's regulars stood alongside the Pennsylvanians of Reynolds's division. He had been exchanged since his capture near Gaines Mill, and hurled back the disjointed rebel attacks that continued on through twilight into darkness. There was panic, but it was not of the kind that had characterized the retreat from this same field the year before. The regulars were staunch, now as then, but there was by no means the same difference, in that respect, between them and the volunteers. Siegel's Germans and the men with Reno also managed to form knots of resistance, while the rest withdrew across Stone Bridge in a drizzle of rain. McDowell, seeing the Iron Brigade hold firm along a critical ridge, put Gibbon in charge of the rearguard and gave him instructions to blow up the bridge when his Westerners had crossed over. After McDowell left, Phil Kearney rode up, empty sleeve, flapping, spike whiskers bristling with anger at the sudden reverse the army had suffered. "I suppose you appreciate the condition of affairs here, sir," he cried. "It's another Bull Run, sir. It's another Bull Run." When Gibbon said he hoped it was not as bad as that, Carney snapped, "Perhaps not. Reno is keeping up the fight. He is not stampeded. I am not stampeded. You are not stampeded. That is about all, sir. My God, that's about all." 2 miles west of there, near Groveton, Lee was composing a dispatch to be telegraphed to Richmond for release by the President. "This army today achieved on the plains of Manassas a signal victory over combined forces of Generals McClellan and Pope. We mourn the loss of our gallant dead in every conflict, yet our gratitude to Almighty God for His mercies rises higher and higher each day. To Him and to the valor of our troops, a nation's gratitude is due." His losses were 1,481 killed, 7,627 wounded, 89 missing. Pope's were 1,724 killed, 8,372 wounded, 5,958 missing. Lee reported the capture of 7,000 prisoners, exclusive of 2,000 wounded left by Pope on the field, along with 30 guns and 20,000 small arms, numerous colors, and a vast amount of stores in addition to those consumed or destroyed by Jackson at Manassas Junction 2 days back. Nor was that all. A larger triumph was reflected in the contrast between the present overall military situation here in the East and that which had existed when Lee assumed command 3 months ago. McClellan had stood within sight of the spires of Richmond. Jackson had been in flight up the Shenandoah Valley, pursued by superior enemy combinations. West Virginia had been completely in Federal hands, as well as most of coastal North Carolina, with invasion strongly threatened from both directions. Now Richmond had not only been delivered, but the Union host was in full retreat on Washington, with the dome of the Capitol practically in view, and government clerks being mustered for a last-ditch defense of the city. The valley was rapidly being scoured of the blue remnants left behind when Pope assembled his army to cross the Rappahannock. West Virginia was almost cleared of Federals, and the North Carolina coast was safe. Except for the garrisons at Fort Monroe and Norfolk, the only bluecoats within 100 miles of the southern capital were prisoners of war and men now busy setting fire to U.S. stores and equipment at Aquia Creek, just north of Fredericksburg, preparing for a hasty evacuation. Nor was that all, either. Beyond all this, there was the transformation effected within the ranks of the Army of Northern Virginia itself, a lifting of morale based on a knowledge of the growth of its fighting skill. Gone were the clumsy combinations of the 7 days, the piecemeal attacks launched headlong against positions of the enemy's own choice. Here in the gallant rivalry of Manassas, where Longstreet's soldiers vied with Jackson's for the suppression of an opponent they despised, the victory formula had apparently been found. Lee's orders had been carried out instinctively, in some cases even before they were delivered. Tonight at Army headquarters, which had been set up in an open field with a campfire of boards to read dispatches by, there was rejoicing and an air of mutual congratulation as officer after officer arrived to report new incidents of triumph. Lee, who had told his wife a month ago, "In the prospect before me, I cannot see a single ray of pleasure during this war," stood in the firelight, gray and handsome, impeccably uniformed, welcoming subordinates with the accustomed grace of a Virginia host. "General, here is someone who wants to speak to you," a staff captain said. Lee turned and saw a smoke-grimed cannoneer standing before him, still with a sponge staff in one hand. "Well, my man, what can I do for you?" "Why, General, don't you know me?" Robert wailed. There was laughter at this, a further lifting of spirits as troop commanders continued to report of the day's successes. Hood rode up, weary but still elated over what he called the most beautiful battle scene I have ever beheld. When Lee, adopting the bantering tone he often used in addressing the blonde young man, asked what had become of the enemy, Hood replied that his Texans had driven them almost at a double quick across Bull Run. He added that it had been a wonderful sight to see the Confederate battle flags dancing after the Federals as they ran in full retreat. Lee dropped his jesting manner and said gravely, "God forbid I should ever live to see our colors moving in the opposite direction." While Lee was at Groveton composing the dispatch to Davis, Pope was at Centerville composing one to Halleck. All things being considered, the two were by no means as different as might have been expected. "We have had a terrific battle again today. Under all the circumstances, both horses and men having been 2 days without food, and the enemy greatly outnumbering us, I thought it best to draw back to this place at dark. The movement has been made in perfect order and without loss. The troops are in good heart and marched off the field without the least hurry or confusion. Do not be uneasy, we will hold our own here. P.S. We have lost nothing, neither guns nor wagons." Of the several inaccuracies here involved, one being the comparison of forces, Lee had had 50,000 men engaged while Pope had had 60,000, exclusive of Banks, who was guarding his trains. The greatest, perhaps, was the one in which he declared that his troops were in good heart. It was true that after the first wild scramble for an exit they had steadied and retired in column under cover of the rearguard action on Henry Hill, but their spirits were in fact so far from being high that they could scarcely have been lower. If Pope did not know the extent of his defeat, his men did. They agreed with the verdict later handed down by one of their corps historians, that Pope had been kicked, cuffed, hustled about, knocked down, run over, and trodden upon as rarely happens in the history of war. His communications had been cut, his headquarters pillaged, a corps had marched into his rear and had encamped at its ease upon the railroad by which he received his supplies. He had been beaten or foiled in every attempt he had made to bag those defiant intruders, and in the end he was glad to find a refuge in the entrenchments of Washington, whence he had sallied forth 6 weeks before, breathing out threatenings and slaughter. They agreed with this in all its harshness, but just now what they mainly were was sullen. They had fought well, and they knew it. Defeat had come not because they were outfought, but because they were outgeneraled, or misgeneraled. As one of their number put it, all knew and felt that as soldiers we had not had a fair chance. The fault, they believed, was Pope's. He had acted like a dunderpate. And McDowell's. He had revived their suspicions by repeating his past performance on this field. General McDowell was viewed as a traitor by a large majority of the officers and men, one diarist wrote, adding, "Thousands of soldiers firmly believed that their lives would be purposely wasted if they obeyed his orders in the time of the conflict. The story was told that one of his regiments had stepped gingerly up to the firing line, loosed a random volley, then turned and made for the rear. The men shouting over their shoulders as they ran, 'You can't play it on us!' Slogging tonight through the drizzle of rain, they saw him sitting his horse beside the pike, identifiable in the murk because of the outlandish silhouette of his canvas helmet. One Massachusetts private nudged another, pointing, and said darkly, 'How guilty he looks with that basket on his head.'" Pope, too, came in for his share of abuse. Open sneering at General Pope was heard on all sides, one veteran observed. Another, passing the luckless commander by the roadside, hailed him with a quote from Horace Greeley, "Go west, young man, go west." Perhaps this had something to do with changing his mind as to the state of his men's hearts. At any rate, when morning came, Sunday, August 31st, he wired Halleck, "Our troops are much used up and worn out," and he spoke of giving the enemy as desperate a fight as I can force our men to stand up to. Franklin's corps had come up the night before in time to establish a straggler line in front of Centerville. Sumner, too, was at hand, giving Pope 20,000 fresh troops with which to oppose the rebels. But his confidence was ebbing. He told Halleck, "I should like to know whether you feel secure about Washington should this army be destroyed. I shall fight it as long as a man will stand up to the work. You must judge what is to be done, having in view the safety of the capital." No sooner had he sent this, however, than a reply to last night's rosy message bucked him up again. "My dear General, you have done nobly," Halleck wired. Don't yield another inch if you can avoid it." Pope thanked him for this considerate commendation, and passed along the encouraging news that Ewell is killed, Jackson is badly wounded. The plan of the enemy will undoubtedly be to turn my flank. If he does so, he will have his hands full. Meanwhile, Franklin's soldiers mocked and taunted the bedraggled Army of Virginia, jeering along the straggler line at its new route to Richmond. Overnight, Pope's confidence took another sickening drop. 3 hours after sunrise, September 1st, he got off another long dispatch to Halleck. After a bold beginning, "All was quiet yesterday and so far this morning. My men are resting. They need it much. I shall attack again tomorrow if I can, the next day certainly." He passed at once to darker matters. "I think it my duty to call your attention to the unsoldierly and dangerous conduct of many brigade and some division commanders of the forces sent here from the peninsula. Every word and act and intention is discouraging and calculated to break down the spirits of the men and produce disaster." In the light of this, he closed with a recommendation that ran counter to the intention expressed at the outset. "My advice to you, I give it with freedom, as I know you will not misunderstand it, is that, in view of any satisfactory results, you draw back this army to the entrenchments in front of Washington, and set to work in that secure place to reorganize and rearrange it. You may avoid great disaster by doing so." While waiting to see what would come of this, he found that Jackson, who was no more wounded than Ewell was dead, was in the act of fulfilling his prediction that Lee would try to turn his flank. Stonewall's men had crossed Bull Run at Sudley Springs, then moved north to the Little River Turnpike, which led southeast to Fairfax Courthouse, 8 miles in the Union rear. Pope pulled the troops of Phil Kearny and Brigadier General I.I. Stevens, who commanded Burnside's other division under Reno, out of their muddy camps and sent them slogging northward to intercept the rebel column. They did so late that afternoon. There beside the pike, around a mansion called Chantilly, a wild fight took place during a thunderstorm so violent that it drowned the roar of cannon. Jackson's march had been slow. Consequently, he was in a grim and savage humor. In the rain-lashed confusion, when one of his colonels requested that his men be withdrawn because their cartridges were too wet to ignite, the reply came back, "My compliments to Colonel Blank, and tell him the enemy's ammunition is just as wet as his." This spirit was matched on the Federal side by Kearny, who dashed from point to point, his empty sleeve flapping as he rode with the reins clamped in his teeth, in order to have his one arm free to gesture with his saber, hoiking his troops up to the firing line and holding them there by showing no more concern for bullets than he did for raindrops. His prescription for success in leading men in battle was a simple one. "You must never be afraid of anything," he had told a young lieutenant 2 days ago. Stevens followed his example, and between them they made Stonewall call a halt. The firing continued into early darkness, when on A.P. Hill's front the men were surprised to see a Union general come riding full tilt toward them, suddenly illuminated by a flash of lightning. They called on him to surrender, but he whirled his mount, leaning forward onto its withers with his arm around its neck, and tried to gallop away in the confusion. They fired a volley that unhorsed him, and when they went out to pick him up, they found that he was dead, lying one-armed in the mud, the back of his coat and the seat of his trousers torn by bullets. They brought his body into their lines. "Poor Kearny," Hill said, looking down at him. "He deserved a better death than that." Stevens, too, was dead by now, shot while leading a charge, and the Federals fell back down the pike and through the woods. They did so more from being disheartened by the loss of their leaders, however, than from being pressed. Jackson did not pursue. Thus ended the Battle of Chantilly, a rain-swept drama with off-stage thunder, vivid flashes of lightning, and an epilogue supplied next morning by Lee, who sent Kearny's body forward under a flag of truce, thinking that the possession of his remains may be a consolation to his family. Pope, by then, was back at Fairfax, within 20 miles of Washington, having received from Halleck the instructions he had sought. You will bring your forces as best you can within or near the line of fortification. As the army retreated, by squads, companies, and broken parts of regiments and brigades, according to one enlisted diarist, its commander lost the final vestige of his former boldness. "The straggling is awful in the regiments from the peninsula," he complained to Halleck. "Unless something can be done to restore tone to this army, it will melt away before you know it." This was a new and different Pope, a Pope not unlike a sawdust doll with most of its stuffing leaked away. A surgeon who looked through a headquarters window the previous evening saw him so. He sat with his chair tipped back against the wall, his hands clasped behind his head, which bent forward, his chin touching his breast, seeming to pay no attention to the generals as they arrived, but to be wholly wrapped in his own gloomy reflections. The doctor wrote long afterward, and being a kind-hearted man who had dealt with much misery in his life, he added, "I pitied him then, I pity him now." It was perhaps the only pity felt for him by anyone in the whole long, weary column slogging its way eastward. Last night's thunderstorm had deepened the mud along the pike, and overhead a scud of clouds obscured the sun, which shed an eerie yellow light upon the sodden fields. In a way, though, the weather was fitting, matching as it did the mood of the retreat. "Everyone you met had an unwashed, sleepy, downcast aspect," one officer observed, "and looked as if he would like to hide his head somewhere from all the world." Now that the immediate danger was past, a still worse reaction of sullenness had set in among the troops, whose mistrust of Pope quite balanced his expressed mistrust of them. As one colonel put it, "No salutary fear kept them in the ranks, and many gave way to the temptation to take a rest. There was everywhere along the road the greatest confusion. Infantry and cavalry, artillery and wagons all hurried on pell-mell in the midst of rallying cries of officers and calls and oaths of the men." Banks had come up from Bristow Station, bringing the army's wagons with him, though he had been obliged to put the torch to all the locomotives and freight cars loaded with stores and munitions from Warrenton and other points below the wreckage of Broad Run Bridge. His corps, having seen no fighting since Cedar Mountain, was assigned the rearguard duty, which consisted mainly of prodding frazzled stragglers back into motion and gathering up abandoned equipment littered along the roadside. At the head of the column, miles away, for the various units were badly strung out, clotted in places and gapped in others as a result of accordion action, rode Pope and McDowell, attended by their staffs and followed closely by the lead division, formerly King's, but now under Brigadier General John P. Hatch, who had succeeded the ailing King. That afternoon the sun came out, but it did little to revive the downcast marchers. Least of all Hatch, who had more cause for gloom than most. He had commanded a cavalry brigade, that being the arm of service he preferred, until Pope relieved him for inefficiency and transferred him to the infantry. So Hatch had this to brood over, in addition to the events of the past few days. Then suddenly up ahead, he saw something that made him forget his and the army's troubles. Off to one side loomed Munson's Hill, which Joe Johnston had held with a dummy gun last winter. From its crown, Hatch knew, you could see the dome of the Capitol. But what engaged his attention just now was a small group of horsemen coming down the road toward Pope and McDowell. Particularly the man in front, who rode a large black horse and wore a vivid yellow sash about his waist. Hatch thought there was something familiar about the trim and dapper way he sat his charger. Then, as the man reined to a halt in front of the two generals, returning their salutes with one of his own, which seemed to carry a little of personal good fellowship to even the humblest private soldier, Hatch knew the unbelievable was true. It was Little Mac. He spurred ahead in time to hear McClellan tell Pope and McDowell he had been authorized to take command of the army. Off to the left rear just then, there was a sudden thumping of artillery, dim in the distance. "What was that?" McClellan asked. Pope said it was probably an attack on Sumner, whose corps was guarding the flank in that direction. Then he inquired if there would be any objection if he and McDowell rode on toward Washington. "None at all," McClellan replied. But as for himself, he was riding toward the sound of gunfire. Before the two could resume their journey, Hatch took advantage of the chance to revenge the wrong he believed had been done when his cavalry brigade was taken from him the month before. Trotting back to the head of his infantry column within easy hearing distance of Pope and McDowell, he shouted, "Boys, McClellan is in command of the army again. Three cheers!" The result, after an instant of shock while the words sank in, was pandemonium. Caps and knapsacks went sailing high in the air, and men who a moment ago had been too weary and dispirited to do anything more than plant one leaden foot in front of the other were cheering themselves hoarse, capering about, and slapping each other joyfully on the back. "From an extreme sadness," one Massachusetts volunteer recalled, "we passed in a twinkling to a delirium of delight. A deliverer had come." This was the reaction all down the column as the news traveled back along its length, pausing at the gaps between units, then being taken up again, moving westward like a spark along a 10-mile train of powder. Such demonstrations were not restricted to green troops, volunteers likely to leap at every rumor. Sykes's regulars, for example, were far back toward the rear and did not learn of the change till after nightfall. They were taking a rest halt, boiling coffee in a roadside field, when an officer on picket duty saw by starlight the familiar figure astride Dan Webster coming down the pike. "Colonel! Colonel!" he hollered, loud enough to be heard all over the area. "General McClellan is here!" Within seconds, every man was on his feet and cheering, raising what one of them called such a hurrah as the Army of the Potomac had never heard before. Shout upon shout went out into the stillness of the night, and as it was taken up along the road and repeated by regiment, brigade, division, and corps, we could hear the roar dying away in the distance. The effect of this man's presence upon the Army of the Potomac, in sunshine or rain, in darkness or in daylight, in victory or defeat, was electrical. Hard put for words to account for the delirium thus provoked, he could only add that it was too wonderful to make it worthwhile attempting to give a reason for it. Nor was the enthusiasm limited to veterans of Little Mac's own army, men who had fought under him before. When Gibbon announced the new commander's arrival to the survivors of the Iron Brigade, they too reacted with unrestrained delight, tossing their hats and breaking ranks to jig and whoop, just as the Peninsula boys were doing. Later that night, Gibbon remembered afterward, the weary, fagged men went into camp cheerful and happy to talk over their rough experience of the past 3 weeks and speculate as to what was ahead. It was Lincoln's doing, his alone, and he had done it against the will of a majority of his advisers. Chase believed that the time had come, beyond all doubt, when either the government or McClellan must go down. And Stanton had prepared and was soliciting cabinet signatures for an ultimatum demanding the immediate removal of George B. McClellan from any command in the armies of the United States. When Welles protested that such a document showed little consideration for their chief, the war secretary bristled and said coldly, "I know of no particular obligation I am under to the president. He called me to a difficult position and imposed on me labors and responsibilities which no man could carry." Already he had secured four signatures, his own, Chase's, Bates's, and Smith's, and was working hard for more. Welles and Blair were obdurate, and Seward was still out of town. When, on the morning of this same September 2nd, he came fuming into the room where his colleagues were waiting for Lincoln to arrive and open the meeting. It was a time of strain. Reports of Pope's defeat had caused Stanton to call out the government clerks, order the contents of the arsenal shipped to New York, and forbid the retail sale of spirituous liquors in the city. Now came the climactic blow as he announced in a choked voice the rumor that McClellan had been appointed to conduct the defense of Washington. The effect was stunning, a sort of reversal of what would happen later that day along the blue column plodding east from Fairfax. Just as Chase was declaring that, if true, this would prove a national calamity, Lincoln came in and confirmed the rumor. That was why he was late for the meeting, he explained. He and Halleck had just come from seeing McClellan and ordering him to assume command of the armies round about the capital. Stanton broke in, trembling as he spoke. No order to that effect has been issued from the War Department. Lincoln turned and faced him. The order is mine, he said, and I will be responsible for it to the country. 4 nights ago he had gone to bed confident that the army had won a great victory on the plains of Manassas, a triumph which, according to Pope, would be enlarged when he took up the pursuit of Jackson's fleeing remnant. Overnight, however, word arrived that it was Pope who was in retreat, not Stonewall, and Lincoln came into his secretary's room next morning, long-faced and discouraged. "Well, John, we are whipped again, I'm afraid," he said. All day the news got worse as details of the fiasco trickled through the screen of confusion. Halleck was a weak prop to lean on. Lincoln by now had observed that his general-in-chief was little more than a first-rate clerk. What was worse, he was apt to break down under pressure, which was presently what happened. Before the night was over, old brains appealed to McClellan at Alexandria. "I beg of you to assist me in this crisis with your ability and experience. I am utterly tired out." Lincoln's mind was also turning in Little Mac's direction, although not without reluctance. Unquestionably, it appeared to him, McClellan had acted badly in regard to Pope. One of his subordinates had even been quoted as saying publicly, "I don't care for John Pope a pinch of owl dung." It seemed to Lincoln that they had wanted Pope to fail, no matter what it cost in the blood of Northern soldiers. McClellan, when appealed to for counsel, had advised the president to concentrate all the reserves in the capital entrenchments and leave Pope to get out of his scrape as best he could. To Lincoln this seemed particularly callous, if not crazy. His mistrust of the young Napoleon was increased. But early Tuesday morning, when Pope warned that unless something can be done to restore tone to this army, it will melt away before you know it, he did what he knew he had to do. "We must use what tools we have," he told his secretary. "There is no man in the army who can man these fortifications and lick these troops of ours into shape half as well as McClellan. If he can't fight himself, he excels in making others ready to fight." So he went to him and told him to return to the army whose wounded were already beginning to pour into the city. And that afternoon, despite the howls of the cabinet, Stanton was squelched, but Chase was sputtering, "I cannot but feel that giving command to McClellan is equivalent to giving Washington to the rebels." Lincoln had Halleck issue the formal order. "Major General McClellan will have command of the fortifications of Washington and of all the troops for the defense of the capital." This left Pope to be disposed of, which was done 3 days later. "The armies of the Potomac and Virginia being consolidated," he was told by dispatch, "you will report for orders to the Secretary of War." Reporting as ordered, he found himself assigned to duty against the Sioux, who had lately risen in Minnesota. From his headquarters in St. Paul, where he was settled before the month was out, Pope protested vehemently against the injustice of being banished to a remote and unimportant command. But there he stayed for the duration. Chapter 7. Two Advances, Two Retreats. On the day Lee wrecked Pope on the plains of Manassas, driving him headlong across Bull Run to begin his scamper for the Washington entrenchments, Kirby Smith accomplished in Kentucky the nearest thing to a canny ever scored by any general, North or South, in the course of the whole war. This slashing blow, the first struck in the two-pronged offensive Bragg had designed to recover for the Confederacy all that had been lost by his predecessors, was delivered in accordance with Smith's precept, announced at the outset that brilliant results will be accomplished only with hard fighting. Accordingly, on August 25th, after a week's rest at Barberville, he had resumed his northward march. There were 21,000 men in his four divisions, but the largest of these, 9,000 strong, the others had about 4,000 each, remained in front of Cumberland Gap, observing the 9,000 Federals who held it, while the rest continued their advance toward the Bluegrass. Meanwhile, this was still the Barrens, which meant that water was scarce, the going rough, and people in general unfriendly. This last might well have been based on fear, however, for the appearance of the marchers, whether they came as liberators or invaders, struck at least one citizen as anything but prepossessing. They were ragged, greasy, and dirty, and some barefoot, and looked more like the bipeds of pandemonium than beings of this earth. They surrounded our wells like the locusts of Egypt, and struggled with each other for the water as if perishing with thirst, and they thronged our kitchen doors and windows, begging for bread like hungry wolves. They tore the loaves and pies into fragments and devoured them. Some even threatened to shoot others if they did not divide with them. Notwithstanding such a motley crew, the alarmed observer added with relief, they abstained from any violence or depredation and appeared exceedingly grateful. As a supplement to what could be cadged in this manner, they gathered apples and roasting ears from roadside orchards and fields, eating them raw on the march with liberal sprinklings of salt, a large supply of which had been procured at Barberville. Spirits were high, and there was much joking up and down the column. CSA, they said, stood for Corn, Salt, and Apples. No matter how much horseplay went on within the column itself, passing through London on the 27th, the men continued to obey their commander's insistence upon the most perfect decorum of conduct toward the citizens and their property. 2 days later, by way of reward for good behavior, they climbed Big Hill, the northern rim of the Barrens, and saw spread out before them, like the promised land of old, the lush and lovely region called the Bluegrass. Years afterward, Smith would remember it as it was today, a long rolling landscape, mellowing under the early autumn rays, and would add that when it burst upon our sight, we were astonished and enchanted. However, there was little time for undisturbed enjoyment of the Pisgah view. Up ahead, near the hamlet of Rogersville, 7 miles short of Richmond, the principal settlement this side of the Kentucky River, the cavalry encountered resistance and was driven back upon the infantry. This was a sundown affair, soon ended by darkness. Although he did not know the enemy's strength, Smith was not displeased at this development, for it indicated that the Federals would make a stand here in the open rather than along the natural line of defense afforded by the bluffs of the river, 8 miles beyond Richmond. Earlier that week he had written Bragg that he would fight everything that presents itself, and now, having issued instructions for his men to sleep on their arms in line of battle, he prepared to do just that at dawn. After more than 100 miles of marching, they were about to be required to prove their right to be where they were, and, if they won, to penetrate farther into what Smith would call the long rolling landscape. The Bluecoats slept in line of battle, too, and there were about 7,000 of them. They were under William Nelson, whom Buell had sent north 2 weeks ago, a month after his promotion to Major General, to take charge of the defense of his native Kentucky. The credit of the selection will be mine, Buell had told him. The honor of success will be yours. Nelson was of a sanguine nature, ardent, loud-mouthed, and violent, a fellow officer called him. But by now, having completed a tour of inspection of what he had to work with, he was not so sure that either credit or success, let alone honor, was very likely to come his way as a result of the contest he saw looming. Kirby Smith was closing on him with an army of 12,000 hardened veterans, while his own, hastily organized into 2 small divisions under 2 ex-civilian brigadiers, was composed almost entirely of green recruits hurried forward by the governors of Ohio and Indiana in response to an urgent call from Washington. Their periods of service ranged in general from 3 weeks to 3 days, and for all his arrogant manner, his 6 feet 5 inches of height and his 300 pounds of weight, Nelson was considerably worried as to what they would do when they heard the first shot fired in their direction. He was not long in finding out. At 2:30 in the morning, August 30th, a courier knocked at his bedroom door in Lexington and informed him that the Confederates had come over Big Hill the previous afternoon, approaching Richmond, but that his two brigadiers, Mahlon Manson and Charles Cruft, were on the alert and had intercepted the Gray Column before it reached the town. This was not at all what Nelson wanted to hear, for he was doubtful that his green men could be maneuvered in open combat, and had intended for them to be pulled back to a better defensive position. Apprehensive, he got dressed and rode forward to see for himself, hearing gunfire as soon as he crossed the Kentucky River. It was well past noon by the time he got to Richmond, however, since he was obliged to travel the byroads to avoid being picked up by rebel horsemen. Arriving at last, he found the troops, as he later declared, in a disorganized retreat, or rather, rout. With the assistance of Manson and Cruft, he got what was left of his army into line on the edge of town, partly under cover of the rock walls and tombstones of a cemetery. Once the rallied men were in position, he walked up and down the firing line, exposing his huge bulk to enemy marksmen, and talking all the while to encourage his nervous recruits. "If they can't hit me, they can't hit anything," he roared as he strode back and forth amid the twittering bullets. In this he was mistaken, as he presently found out. They hit him twice, in fact, both flesh wounds, no less painful for being superficial. But what hurt him worst, apparently, was the conduct of his men, who refused to be encouraged by his example. "Our troops stood about 3 rounds," he afterwards reported, "when, struck by a panic, they fled in utter disorder. I was left with my staff almost alone." He made his escape, considerably hampered by a bullet in his thigh. So did Cruft, but not Manson, who was pinned under his fallen horse and captured. Nelson listed his casualties as 206 killed, 844 wounded, 4,303 captured or missing. Smith's were 78 killed, 372 wounded, 1 missing out of the approximately 7,000 he too had had engaged. After the initial decision to give battle, he had left the tactical details to the commander of his lead division, Brigadier General Patrick R. Claiborne, who had charge of the two brigades sent by Bragg from Chattanooga. Claiborne was Irish, about as Irish, in fact, as possible, having been born in County Cork on St. Patrick's Day 34 years ago. As a youth, he had done a hitch in the British Army, rising to the rank of corporal, then had emigrated to Helena, Arkansas, where he studied and practiced law with the same diligence he applied to his other two prime absorptions, pistol marksmanship and chess. When the war broke out, he was elected captain of the local volunteer company, the Yell Rifles. By the time of Shiloh, he had attained his present rank and led his brigade of Tennesseans, Mississippians, and Arkansans with conspicuous skill and gallantry through that fight. Today in Kentucky, he did likewise, keeping up a slow fire with his guns until the situation was developed, then launching an attack which broke the first of the 3 lines the Bluecoats managed to form between then and sundown. Claiborne himself was not on hand for the breaking of the others, nor for the rounding up of the fugitives in the twilight. While speaking to a wounded colonel, he was struck in the left cheek by a bullet that knocked his teeth out on that side, before emerging from his mouth, which, as one who was with him said, fortunately happened to be open, and forced his retirement speechless from the field. But the continued application of his tactics against the subsequent 2 rallies produced the same results. Together with the capture of about 4,000 prisoners, the entire Union wagon train, substantial army stores, 10,000 small arms, and 9 guns. "Tomorrow being Sunday," Smith announced in his congratulatory order, "the general desires that the troops shall assemble and, under their several chaplains, shall return thanks to Almighty God, to whose mercy and goodness these victories are due." The day was also spent attending the wounded, burying the dead, and paroling the host of prisoners, after which preparations were made for continuing the advance. September 1st, unopposed, three-fourths of Nelson's army had been shot or captured, the rest were fugitives hiding out in the woods and cornfields. The Gray Marchers crossed the Kentucky River and made camp on the northern bank. Next day they entered Lexington, where large numbers of townspeople turned out to greet them with smiles and cheers, including a delegation of ladies who presented Smith with a flag they had embroidered in his honor. September 3rd, his troopers rode into Frankfort to find the governor and the legislature fled to Louisville. Having no suitable Confederate ensign with them, the Graybacks raised the colors of the 1st Louisiana Cavalry over the State House. Another southern capital had returned to what the victors called its true allegiance. Lexington had been the goal announced by Smith when he left Knoxville, and there he made his headquarters throughout September, in virtual control of central Kentucky, while waiting for Bragg to join or send for him. Back at Cumberland Gap, after holding out through a month of siege, the Federals under George Morgan blew up their magazine, set fire to a warehouse containing 6,000 small arms, and made their escape across the Barrens via Manchester and Boonville to Greenup on the Ohio River, eluding pursuers all 200 miles of the way. This was a disappointment to Smith, who had counted on capturing his West Point classmate, but at least it permitted his other division to join him at Lexington. Meanwhile, he had not been idle. In addition to occupying Frankfort, Cynthiana, Georgetown, and Paris, he sent sizable detachments of cavalry and infantry to demonstrate against Louisville and Cincinnati, both of which were thrown into turmoil. Summoned to command the defense of the latter city, Lew Wallace decreed martial law, ordered all business activities suspended, and impressed citizens to resume work on the fortifications begun the year before at Covington and Newport on the opposite bank of the Ohio. "To arms," the Cincinnati Gazette urged its readers. "The time for playing war has passed. The enemy is now approaching our doors." Smith was not so much concerned with the reaction of the people of Ohio, however, as he was with the reaction of the people of Kentucky. "So far, this had been most gratifying," he informed the adjutant general on September 6th. "It would be impossible for me to exaggerate the enthusiasm of the people here on the entry of our troops. They evidently regarded us as deliverers from oppression, and have continued in every way to prove to us that the heart of Kentucky is with the South in this struggle. If Bragg occupies Buell, we can have nothing to oppose us but raw levies, and by the blessing of God we'll always dispose of them as we did on the memorable August 30th. His purpose in seeming to threaten Cincinnati, he added, was, in order to give the people of Kentucky time to organize, and by way of encouragement, he broadcast assurances to the citizens in the form of proclamations. "Let no one make you believe we come as invaders, to coerce your will or to exercise control over your soil. Far from it. We come to test the truth of what we believe to be a foul aspersion, that Kentuckians willingly join the attempt to subjugate us and to deprive us of our prosperity, our liberty, and our dearest rights. Are we deceived? Can you treat us as enemies? Our hearts answer, no." Bragg, too, was in Kentucky by now, and he, too, was issuing proclamations assuring the people that he had come not to bind them but to assist them in striking off their chains. "Kentuckians, I have entered your state with the Confederate Army of the West and offer you an opportunity to free yourselves from the tyranny of a despotic ruler. We come not as conquerors or as despoilers, but to restore to you the liberties of which you have been deprived by a cruel and relentless foe. We come to guarantee to all the sanctity of their homes and altars, to punish with a rod of iron the despoilers of your peace, and to avenge the cowardly insults to your women. Will you remain indifferent to our call, or will you rather vindicate the fair fame of your once free and envied state? We believe that you will, and that the memory of your gallant dead who fell at Shiloh, their faces turned homeward, will rouse you to a manly effort for yourselves and posterity. Kentuckians, we have come with joyous hopes. Let us not depart in sorrow, as we shall if we find you wedded in your choice to your present lot. If you prefer federal rule, show it by your frowns, and we shall return whence we came. If you choose rather to come within the folds of our brotherhood, then cheer us with the smiles of your women, and lend your willing hands to secure you in your heritage of liberty. Dated September 14th at Glasgow, which he had reached the day before, the proclamation was issued during a 2-day rest halt, the first he had made in the course of the more than 150 miles his army had covered since leaving Chattanooga 17 days ago. Despite their exertions, the men were in excellent spirits. Marching over Walden's Ridge, then up the lovely Sequatchie Valley to Pikeville, where they swung east across the Cumberland Plateau, thus passing around Buell's left wing at Deckard, they enjoyed the scenery, the bracing air of the uplands, and the friendly offerings of buttermilk and fried chicken by country people all along the way. Bragg was happy, too, and with cause. Strategically, as events disclosed, the movement had been as sound as it was rapid. He had predicted that Buell would recede to Nashville before giving us battle, and now his scouts reported that this was just what Buell was doing as fast as he could, which meant that North Alabama and Chattanooga, along with much of Middle Tennessee, had already been relieved without the firing of a shot. To cap the climax, when he drew near Sparta on September 5th, halfway across Tennessee, he received a dispatch from Kirby Smith reporting the destruction of Nelson's army and urging him to move into Kentucky and effecting a junction with my command and holding Buell's communications, to give battle to him with superior forces and with certainty of success. Then and there, by way of celebration, Bragg issued a congratulatory address to his soldiers, informing them of Smith's lopsided victory and Buell's hasty withdrawal. "Comrades, our campaign opens most auspiciously and promises complete success. The enemy is in full retreat, with consternation and demoralization devastating his ranks. To secure the full fruits of this condition, we must press on vigorously and unceasingly." Press on they did, and vigorously, for Bragg had now decided on his goal, finally abandoning any intention to launch an assault on Nashville, where Buell was concentrating his forces and improving the fortifications. He marched hard for Glasgow. 8 days later, he arrived and, calling a halt, issued the proclamation announcing his joyous hopes that the people of Kentucky would assist him in punishing with a rod of iron the despoilers of your peace. He was exactly where he wanted to be, squarely between Buell and Kirby Smith, whom he could summon to join him. Or, if he chose, he could move on to the Bluegrass and the Ohio, combining there with Smith to capture Louisville or Cincinnati, both of which were nearer to him now than they were to Buell. On the day Bragg issued his proclamation at Glasgow, where his four divisions were taking a hard-earned rest, Buell entered Bowling Green, 35 miles to the west. He had 5 divisions with him and 3 more back at Nashville under Thomas, who was serving as his second-in-command through the present crisis. His total strength, including a division just arrived from Grant, was 56,000, exactly twice Bragg's, though Buell did not know this, having lately estimated it at 60,000, not including the troops with Kirby Smith. The past 2 weeks had been for him in the nature of a nightmare. So much had happened so fast, and nearly all of it unpleasant. Having transferred his headquarters in rapid succession from Stevenson to Deckard to McMinnville, he shifted them once again to Murfreesboro on the day Bragg set out north from Chattanooga. He did this, he told Thomas, by way of preparation for the offensive. "Once concentrated, we may move against the enemy wherever he puts himself if we are strong enough." This sentence, as a later observer remarked, had an escape clause at both ends, and Buell was not long in giving more weight to them than to the words that lay between. 2 days later, while Bragg was passing around his left and Smith was wrecking Nelson up at Richmond, he notified Andrew Johnson, the military governor of Tennessee, "These facts make it plain that I should fall back on Nashville, and I am preparing to do so. I have resisted the reasons which lead to the necessity until it would be criminal to delay any longer. He arrived September 2nd to find the Capitol barricaded with cotton bales and bristling with cannon. Inside, Governor Johnson defied the rebels, declaring heatedly that he would defend the citadel with his heart's blood and never be taken alive. Encouraged by this, as well as by the arrival of 10,000 men from Grant, Buell wired Halleck, "I believe Nashville can be held and Kentucky rescued. What I have will be sufficient here with the defenses that are being prepared, and I propose to move with the remainder of the army against the enemy in Kentucky." 2 nights ago, swamped by troubles resulting from Nelson's and Pope's simultaneous defeats, Old Brains had thrown up his hands and complained to McClellan that he was utterly tired out. By now, though, he had recovered enough to send a one-sentence reply to Buell's wire. "Go where you please," he told him, "provided you will find the enemy and fight him." Buell went nowhere until September 7th. Warned then that Bragg was headed for Bowling Green, where a large supply of provisions had been stored for the campaign which had already gone up in smoke, he set out for that point with 5 of his 8 divisions, leaving Thomas to hold Nashville with the others in case the gray invaders doubled back. A week later he got there, only to find that Bragg was at Glasgow, which not only placed him nearer Louisville than the Federals were, but also enabled him to call on Smith for reinforcements. In danger of being attacked, as he thought, by superior numbers, Buell wired for Thomas to hurry north with 2 divisions, explaining